Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Since its introduction to the U.S. more than a decade ago, the e-cigarette industry has boomed. Roughly 9 million Americans say they vape. And e-cigarettes, which have gained a foothold with teenagers, are billed as a safer alternative to smoking. Now, the Food and Drug Administration has issued new rules that, for the first time, extend federal oversight to e-cigarettes, making them illegal to anyone under 18. Joining us in the studio is Director of Cancer and Pulmonology Services at Ohio Health Doctors Hospital, Kim Heeman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
Also in the studio, public health and law professor at Ohio State University and former senior advisor to the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products, Micah Berman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, could one of you, Micah, or I guess Kim Heeman, could you tell us how an e-cigarette actually works? What's going on?
Sure. Well, you know, cigarettes have been around since forever, and I think the tobacco companies and quite a few other small businesses were trying to come up with a new sexy way of because the perception of cigarettes is really it's not the sexy thing to do anymore.
Putting tar and nicotine into your
exactly. Gun. So yeah. With technology, e-cigarettes basically use a combustible liquid, but they're powered by electronically either by an activator in it that uses a battery or there's several different kind of types of vapors, which is why the subject of vapors is so complicated. And we're all really just learning the different types. There's mod pods, there's different small, sleek, little disposable ones. There are pen-shaped battery component that ignite a combustible liquid that then creates a vapor to inhale.
And there are vape bars where people go to try out different kinds. Is that a thing, or is that just a way to the industry is trying to break into a market? Micah?
It's certainly a thing. There are stores really popping up all around Columbus and all across the country that are selling different types of these e-cigarettes or vapor products. And a lot of them you can actually go in and try out these different products, sample different products, and decide what you want. That's one way these products are being sold. They're also being sold just at the convenience stores where you get cigarettes. There are also e-cigarette products for sale there.
Are they expensive?
They can really range in price from you can get free vouchers online. You can try different brands for free all the way to go into these vapor stores, trying them different flavorings. You can really get into really a out-of-pocket cost pretty significant.
Yeah. But it has to be competitive with cigarettes ultimately.
Absolutely. Well, it all comes down to perception. I think a lot of consumers who don't want to necessarily be put into the smoking category, they don't consider themselves using being a smoker if they're using e-cigarettes. And they're attractive. Sometimes, you know, you can go into a public location and you see a huge smoke cloud surrounding someone. They're using a mod vapor. So they're very different. There's different kinds, but it's very alluring. That's for sure.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about new federal regulations regarding e-cigarettes or vapes or however you want to refer to them. It's getting the nicotine without a lot of the bad things we associate with cigarettes. However, what we have not known and what the FDA, I think, wants to get at is what actually is in vape, what's inside of those. And Micah Berman, what do we know about that?
Well, these new regulations are incredibly significant because until now there was no requirement for people even to report what was in these products. And now the FDA has that authority to require that information to be reported and they can collect that. So as Kim explained, the product itself is really pretty simple. It's usually a nicotine solution that has some sort of carrier and some sort of flavor in it that then gets turned into an aerosol. But there are lots of studies out there that show that what's on the label of these products isn't always what's in them. The nicotine level that's reported isn't necessarily what the nicotine level actually is. So now the FDA will have oversight to be able to get at some of those issues.
And how's this going to roll out?
So some of the pieces of the rule go into effect almost immediately. So, for example, not being able to sell to people
to 18-year-olds,
the age of 18 goes into effect immediately. But a lot of these provisions roll out over time. So one of the more significant ones that certainly the e-cigarette industry is most concerned about is the FDA will have the authority over time to review these products and essentially decide whether it would be appropriate for protection of public health is actually the language of the statute and the rule. They have to decide whether or not it would be good for public health to allow particular e-cigarette products to be sold. So those decisions won't be made immediately, but those are decisions that the FDA will have to make over time.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think from a public health standpoint, it would be really interesting to look at the FDA regulations and how it's going to affect smaller businesses that are in the vape industry,
right,
and how that's going to affect the tobacco companies. I think with the FDA regulations, it looks like a 3-year rule that they have to submit so much paperwork to be able to show the health claims that they're making on the e-cigarettes that they can help tobacco cessation and they don't have the harmful effects that traditional tobacco products have. They're making a lot of claims. So they really have to prove that their claims are true and to have these small businesses try to stay up with these new FDA regulations is going to be really interesting in the industry.
What do we know about why it is so dominated by smaller businesses? Is it because anyone can sort of buy the implements, buy the parts and put them together at a local level?
The retail sales have been to some extent dominated by small businesses because it's pretty easy, low startup cost to be able to start that kind of business and bring in new customers. The industry itself, where the majority of the sales are coming from, isn't small business. The small business sector is there, but it's some of the major tobacco companies that are investing heavily in e-cigarettes as well.
And it'll be the producers of the product, the oils and whatever it is that goes into this, of the materials that go into it, they're the ones that have to prove the claims,
correct,
not
right,
the local retail level seller.
That's right.
Okay. Most e-liquids come in several strengths. I was surprised to read high, medium, low, and zero. How do these... What do we know about the relationship between those varying levels and how they influence nicotine dependence?
At Ohio Health Doctors Hospital, I conduct classes for those who are interested in quitting smoking. And in the last about a year, I've noticed quite a few patients who have been referred have used e-cigarettes. A lot of them were using them for tobacco cessation, and they were not even aware that some of them contained nicotine. They were thinking that it was that behavioral support that they were getting while they were trying to wean down their tobacco use. So it's been interesting to educate a lot of consumers and patients that there are the different strengths. I've had several patients actually mixing their own e-cigarette additives in their garages and basements, and what strength they're getting, we don't know. So there's a lot of variability to these, and there's a lot of unknowns for the consumers that are purchasing these. But with that, with the lack of regulations, we really don't know. There's a lot of variability. There's a couple studies that have pulled and sampled several of the same type of e-cigarette, and the nicotine that was supposed to be a high or moderate or low, there's a wide 10%, 20% variability in that nicotine percentages that's contained in the e-cigarettes themselves.
When you're conducting a smoking cessation program, are you trying to get people to stop smoking, or are you trying to get them off of nicotine?
We are trying to – the end goal is to get them – to quit smoking. We use a lot of nicotine replacement therapies. So the nicotine gum, the nicotine patch, the nicotine inhaler. So a lot of the confusion is, well, isn't an e-cigarette just as the same as I'm inhaling the nicotine, just like the nicotine inhaler product? The difference is those NRT products are all controlled by the FDA. You kind of know what milligram of nicotine you're getting. Nicotine itself, you can compare to caffeine. There are some effects of it, but really the harm reduction is getting them off the tobacco product because of the many other chemicals contained in them that we do know cause cancer and the many other effects of the tobacco products.
Micah Berman, at this point, can we compare vape products and how they'll be regulated by the FDA with how tobacco products are regulated by the FDA?
This regulation puts them in the same category.
It puts them in the same category.
Tobacco products.
And,
yes.
And what are the? How does it work for submitting a new tobacco product now?
Well, the process, as I said, is going to unroll over a couple of years. But essentially, for any product that was introduced after March of 2007, companies are going to have to submit paperwork to the FDA that either shows that it was comparable to a product that was on the market before that time. And for e-cigarette products, that's going to be very hard to do because there just weren't that many e-cigarette products on the market before that time. Or they're going to have to show data showing that it would not be harmful to public health, or essentially it would benefit public health to allow these products to continue to be sold. And the FDA hasn't provided a lot of guidance yet as to what exactly it's going to want to see in those applications. So that's something that the FDA will have to explain over time. And that's actually some of the research that we're doing at Ohio State, is to help come up with the processes and the methods and the type of studies that would be needed to make that determination.
The new rules also apply to hookah tobacco, pipe tobacco, and cigars. And I thought, weren't those already regulated?
No. So I think that's surprising to a lot of people that the FDA gave,
especially the pipe tobacco thing.
That's right, yeah. So the FDA was given the authority in 2009 to regulate tobacco, but the Act of Congress essentially just gave it the authority initially to regulate cigarettes and smokeless tobacco, and then it said that it could, by rule, extend its regulatory power to other types of tobacco, including cigars and pipes and hookah tobacco. And so that was in 2009, and it's taken 7 years for this rule to actually be issued. So I think that was a pretty significant delay, and a lot of people didn't realize that in the interim there was a pretty big regulatory gap.
Right. So when you're doing smoking cessation, do you ever have people who are coming to you because they're trying to get off cigars or pipes?
It's very common, even really? Smokeless tobacco.
Really?
Yes. And a lot of it is that perception, and, you know, they think that they're doing less harm. Well, I'm not smoking cigarettes. I'm not smoking a pack or two or three a day.
But there's still nicotine in all of those things?
There's still nicotine, and there's a cigar, even those little cigars, they can contain three times the amount of nicotine as a cigarette.
My dad was lying to me all those years. So, okay, so there's nicotine in pretty much everything tobacco.
Absolutely.
And the hookah bars, same?
Yep.
So hookah can be made with tobacco, and there are also hookah products that are made without tobacco.
Okay. Okay. You mean that you smoke something, but it's nicotine, but it's not tobacco?
No, there are some where essentially you're inhaling flavored smoke, but it's not coming from tobacco.
All right.
But there's no nicotine in those, but it depends on the product. And actually, this is going to be a complication going forward because the FDA rule only applies to products that have nicotine in it. And so there are some e-cigarette products out there. There are some hookah products out there that don't have nicotine in them. And so those products are still not under any regulatory authority.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick call from Grayson in Cincinnati. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Let me have the call right now. We're waiting for Grayson. Let me have the call right now. Okay, we don't have time to get the call. Thanks to you both, Kim Heeman, Director of Cancer and Pulmonology Services at Ohio Health Doctors Hospital. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you, Ann.
And also Micah Berman, Public Health and Law Professor at OSU and former Senior Advisor to the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
All right. You will have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When you break a bone, you can see it. A concussion is more complicated. Even well-educated sports trainers sometimes struggle to identify symptoms of a concussion on the field or the sidelines. Researchers are exploring the use of virtual reality now to better detect and therefore treat sports-related concussions. Joining us by phone is neurosurgeon and director of the Concussion and Brain Performance Center at Stanford University, Dr. Jamchi Gajar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us in the studio, Christine Gross. She's CEO of SportsBrain, a local company that's using virtual reality technology for concussion diagnosis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christine, I wanted to start with you. Your company, SportsBrain, uses virtual reality technology to test for concussions. What is the technology? How does it work?
The technology is really interesting. So the Oculus Rift VR goggles, virtual reality goggles, are connected to a laptop, and we run a software program that will measure balance, reaction time, and spatial memory. What's interesting about this test is it's fully immersive in a gaming environment, which makes it fun for kids and professional athletes to do the test. It takes about 15 minutes, and we run the balance test, and it measures movement from side to side. So you're placed into a room where the room moves, and you have to try and stay as still as possible while you're standing up heel to toe. And then in the reaction time, the room moves again, but you have to move with it. So moving backwards, forwards, and then tilting at the hips. And then in the spatial memory, we use an Xbox controller where they have to make a series of four turns through a maze, get to a door, and then find the return path. So
what does this indicate about a possible concussion?
Well, first of all, what we're trying to promote is baseline concussion testing. Okay. We want to know what the normal
brain
function is.
Which already exists, but not in virtual reality form.
Right. So it's important to have data from a baseline concussion test so that if there is a brain injury, we have data to compare it to. We can provide it to the doctors who then can make the decision about when it's safe to return an athlete to the field.
Dr. Gajjar, last season Stanford football utilized the eye tracking technology to test players for symptoms. What did you find?
Well, the iSync technology made by SyncThink is, and I'm a director of SyncThink, is used on the sidelines as part of their NCAA protocol to screen for concussions. So they use that and also an instrument called SCAT-3, which is a working memory balance a test. And the two of them together, they use the screen for concussions and make decisions about going back to play.
And how did using that technology compare to previous seasons? Going back to play or fewer going back to play or what?
Yeah. So just a helicopter view, you know, concussion definition is not been described. So there are 40 different definitions out there. And it's really a physician diagnosis. There's no accepted diagnostic criteria. So the way we're approaching it is the main functions, brain functions that are impaired after concussion are attention and balance. And so technologies that measure attention or balance are probably the way to go because if somebody's impaired, you don't want to put them back into a contact sport where they can get injured. And frankly, you don't want them driving a car either. Mm-hmm. And so measuring those cognitive and neurological abilities are very important to decide whether to put them back in play or not. So measuring eye tracking is a form of attention, visual attention. In fact, 90% of what we do in the outside world is visual. So keeping up with the outside world is very important. So that's why I use eye tracking technology for that.
Why has it been so difficult to diagnose concussions? Is it be different descriptions of what a concussion is?
Yeah, well, we reviewed a study we published in Neurosurgery, the guidelines for concussion. We reviewed 5,000 research articles, and unfortunately, a lot of them don't measure the function every day after somebody gets a hit to the head. And the other problem is a lot of people have previous conditions like ADHD or learning disorders, and so it's difficult to establish when there's really a brain change. And a lot of these tests are not, there's learning effects, effort issues, and so they interfere with the baseline. I think most of the public thinks that if you get a baseline test, that is, you know, 100% valid, and then if there's any change from that, that's a concussion. Well, you can get lots of changes if you just take somebody and sleep deprive them. You'll get a lot of changes in cognitive changes that look very much like a concussion, but that's from sleep deprivation. It's not from a brain injury.
And, of course, we always have the issue of athletes not wanting to own up to something when you have to rely on their reporting.
That's a whole other thing. We have to, you know, right now there's spotter technology in NFL, and there's sideline athletic directors who pick out people who possibly have a concussion. So we don't know. That technology needs to be improved. And I think accelerometers that are going to be used on the on players, they can pick up significant forces to the head and then bring them to the sideline and do some kind of evaluation is probably the way to go.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the use of virtual reality to better detect and therefore treat sports-related concussions. With me in the studio, Christine Gross. She's CEO of SportsBrain. It's a local company that's using virtual reality technology for concussion diagnosis. And with us by phone, Dr. Jamshid Gajar. He's a neurosurgeon and director of the Concussion and Brain Performance Center at Stanford University. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And just to be clear, Dr. Gajar, most concussions are sports related?
No, actually, most of them are from the largest cause of concussion is probably bicycle riding, because a lot of people ride bicycles. If you look at just total number of concussions, right, it would be from that. If you look at traumatic brain injury in general, falls in the elderly are very common now, and actually exceed motor vehicle accidents. So if you look at the totality, it goes from falls, motor vehicle accidents, sporting, assaults. But there's a lot of focus, obviously, on sporting because of the NFL and all that. I think getting back to your question about virtual reality, mm-hmm. it you know, for eye tracking, it isolates the eyes. So you can very quickly analyze the eye movements and pick up impairments. I think it's a great environment that allows you, as your other guest was talking about, it allows you to assess the other key component, which is balance. There's accelerometers on the virtual reality goggles. You can tell where the person's positioned. You can measure it, and so you can measure balance issues. So what we're coming down to is what are the practical measurements we need to measure in these players? And it comes down to attention, which you can measure with eye tracking, and vestibular balance, which you can do in a virtual environment. So I think it's very, very exciting technology, and I think you'll see a lot of neurological applications on VR in the future.
Christine Gross, who are you shooting for? Who's your market? Who do you want to sell this to?
We work with a lot of schools and athletic organizations. We also work with professional and semi-professional sports. So really, we're targeting the end user. But ultimately, we're also talking to legislators, because we do want to see baseline concussion testing become part of the school physical. I think that's a few years down the road, but we're starting the conversation.
And the issue about when you're talking about high school kids and that kind of thing, they don't want to be taken out of the game. Has that been an issue? I mean, is that something this kind of testing, they can't trick it?
Exactly. So the thing that's exciting about VR technology is that there's no practice effect. It doesn't cause fatigue, and you can't cheat it. A lot of the existing baseline tests that are on the market, the neurocognitive tests, haven't changed in over 20 years. And so these kids have been taking the test every year for, you know, let's say 6 years since they were in fifth grade, and they know how to cheat it. And in fact, we've tested some high school students who have told us, I know this test. I know how to cheat it. And that's when we started looking at there's a whole lot of technology that's on the market right now. We're looking for the best solution to provide evidence-based data so that physicians, such as the doctor that's on the line, can return those athletes safely to the field.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Once again, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rob in Clintonville, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is about the National Hockey League and the National Football League. It seems like in hockey they're a little bit further along with their concussion protocols, and I was just wondering if the two leagues work together at all, or what their thoughts are about both those leagues, NFL and NHL.
I don't know if we're actually talking about that. We're more talking about virtual reality using VR technology to determine whether or not there's been a concussion. So that might not fit in right here right now, Rob. Sorry about that. Do you see, Dr. Gajar, this technology going into lots of different areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is probably that everyone's going to be buying VR goggles for gaming or other, you know, I mean, if you want to go, say, for instance, you're in the home buying market and you want to see a home, or you want to go to a museum virtually, you can just put your goggles on and do it. So I think a lot of people will have them, and the really upside is that if everyone has one of these, just like a laptop computer, they can use it for like rehabilitation or assessment at home. So I think that's very exciting from that point of view. A lot of these applications will be apps on VR, called sort of neurological apps. And so people will be able to take it and assess everything from sleep deprivation to, I think the big use of this will be from assessing neurologically whether somebody's sleep deprived, because that really affects functions. We're finding that a lot of kids around here playing sports don't get enough sleep, and the injury rates are sky high. And so, you know, affects playing sports, but also driving too. A lot of drivers are impaired because of sleep deprivation. Like, so sleep deprived nation. So having metrics around that, showing that, and they have, you know, like Fitbit and other wearable technologies that you can sort of assess your sleep. But you really don't, you can't. You're not assessing your neurological state, whether you're ready to go, you're cognitively ready. And I think part of the baseline testing in athletes is going to be turning into surveillance. So, like, who is really focused, has good attention focus, that can go and play a game? Because I think for the insurance industry and for the schools, minimizing injuries is key. So if we can survey the athletes and see which ones can really focus, those are the people you want to play contact sports, or any sports for that matter.
That's really interesting. Are you envisioning that kind of world, too, where we can actually use virtual reality, Christine Gross, to screen?
Right now, yeah, they're actually using it as a performance measure. There are some Division I schools are actually using virtual reality as a performance measure, particularly in reaction time.
Making sure they're showing up for practice, ready to practice, or a game.
Right. And plus, they want to see pre- and post-season performance. So they can run a test before and after the season and see how they've improved.
Okay. Dr. Gajar?
Yeah, I think the baseline test, though, is this sort of notion that you take a picture of somebody before, then you take a picture of them after a game, and you can compare the two. It's really not like that, because a lot of these tests are really, as your other guest said, you know, sort of effort, learning issues, and so on. I think we need to use it more. We need to have better tests that can assess the person's readiness to play a sport or get into a car, for that matter. And then when we're actually assessing them on the sideline, I think there's going to be, you know, a unique signature for concussion that you'll be able to pick up, whether, you know, be eye tracking or vestibular balance or other tests. I think in the future we'll have a unique, and we won't require the baseline. The baseline will turn into a surveillance test.
Okay.
So you'll be able to figure out who's fit to play or drive a car, for that matter.
Now, I just want to make sure, do we know yet? I mean, Dr. Gajar, could people trick VR? I mean, we know that people, particularly young people who don't want to be taken out of a game, think they can game the system as it stands now, the traditional way with the baseline and but what about with VR?
Well, I wouldn't talk more about VR. I'd say, what is it that you really want in an athlete that maximizes performance? And I think they have to have attention. They have to have the ability to pay attention. And they have to have balance intact. Otherwise, they're going to get injured again. So it's hard to game good attention. I mean, if you can game it, then you probably have good attention. So the question is, what's the test? So I think that it's not so much the gaming part is really because of the nature of the test. And we have to have better tests that assess the nature of attention and are reliable. And we'll get away from the learning issues and effort issues.
And how does balance change when you are experiencing a concussion? What does it look like? Do we know yet?
So there is jitter. So if you look at eye movements, what happens is if you try and the test that SyncThink has got that Stanford uses is it's a dot going around a circle. And there's cameras. By the way, what we do is we put cameras inside VR, which are not there right now. So if you're gaming on VR, you have to move your head to get a scene change. But what we do is we put cameras in so you can look at the eye position. So eventually gaming will have, you know, usually when we're looking around, we look with our eyes. We don't move our entire head and body. Right now in VR, you have to move your head to get a scene change. But in the future, Oculus Rift and other companies will start putting eye trackers in. At that point, you know where the eyes are, and you'll change the scene in VR accordingly. So, but once you have that, you can see where the eye position is, and you can see how well somebody follows something. And that's a measure of attention. As far as balance goes, what you're looking at is a person maintaining balance. And what you see is jitter. They have a lot of jitter, and they can't maintain their balance.
And
you see a similar thing in eye movements, too. There's a jittery eye movement.
Okay. And Christine Gross, you're just nodding your head. This is all familiar to you as far as what you do and what you provide.
Absolutely. And what the doctor said is absolutely correct. I mean, if you're looking at a concussed person and their eye tracking, it is jittery and your eyes move in a non-smooth kind of pattern.
But it has to be done while you're supposedly doing something. You have to be looking at it while they're trying to navigate.
You have to be focused. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It can't just be someone sitting down on the bench on the sidelines with and have you putting a flashlight in their eye to look at how their eyes
are. That's how they're currently doing it.
Right, right. And just to be real clear, Dr. Gajar, the idea is that they're doing something and you want to see how their eye movement operates when they're doing something.
That's what you do all day long. You're predicting what's about to happen. This is all about predicting what's about to happen. And so by the time you see something, your brain recognizes half a second later. So you actually have to anticipate or predict the outside world. And what we're doing is just looking at how well you do that with your eyes. And you can do it in 30 seconds. This test that the Stanford people use, 30 seconds in VR, and you get a result right away. So it's very quick.
What about sports brain? How fast is the test for that?
So there's a number of tests that we deploy. The VR test to do a full baseline or post-injury assessment takes 15 minutes because there's a battery of tests that we do. There are three balance tests that we run, five reaction time, and then the spatial memory test takes a larger portion of time.
Is it expensive? Is it going to be more expensive for schools where kids are already limited because of playing fees and all that?
Schools are really going to more of an online concussion management tracking kind of system because they're concerned about liability, as the doctor had mentioned, and they're concerned about returning to play, making sure that they are adhering to state laws related to return to play. So what they want is just an online dashboard, if you will, that shows what the baseline was, if there was an incident of concussion, what the symptoms are, was that relayed back to the doctor, and then what was the final diagnosis, and have they been returned to play by a medical professional? Okay. So that's what the schools are looking for.
Well, Christine Gross, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Christine Gross is CEO of SportsBrain. It's a local company, a new local company that's using virtual reality technology for concussion diagnosis. And Dr. Jamshid Gajar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Gajar is a neurosurgeon and director of the Concussion and Brain Performance Center at Stanford University. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's a question we ask ourselves again and again. What's more important, diet or exercise? Exercise or diet? For years, food studies, researchers, and diet bloggers have suggested that it's diet all the way and that exercise on its own isn't as effective as what you consume. Now, a recent study indicates that may not be the case for weight loss. Joining us now to talk about that and more exercise news is New York Times phys ed columnist Gretchen Reynolds. Welcome back, Gretchen.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it is the eternal weight loss question. I know you and I have talked about it before, exercise or diet. Why don't we have a definitive answer yet?
Because the human body and the human brain are incredibly complicated. We can do lots of really good studies with animals and show things that don't actually then turn out to be quite the same in people. We're just really complicated. And we also don't, I mean, that one thing that I should make really clear is the study that I wrote about, and I'll talk about it in a second, is about avoiding weight gain in the first place. And there basically are sort of three elements to weight control that tend to get sort of smooshed together, and they're very separate. One is avoiding gaining weight, particularly gaining fat, because fat changes everything once you've got it on your body. If you can avoid fat in the first place, that changes the whole trajectory of sort of your weight control for life. The second is losing weight once you actually have put on weight, once especially you've gained fat. That is really, really, really hard. And so far, no one has cracked the code of how to lose weight and then, part three, keep it off.
Right.
So there are three parts. You have to try not to gain the fat, try to lose it if you have gained it, and then try to keep it off. And so far, we don't understand how any of those work. But the the study that I wrote about, which was in rats, I should make it very clear, it's an animal study, was looking at whether exercise could keep animals that basically were born to become fat. They're a kind of rodent that is very prone to obesity. And whether if they exercised before they became fat, they would not become fat. And they didn't, which is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, in all fairness to rats, they study rats to determine human behaviors, because rats are a lot like us in some ways.
They are, and rats that are bred to become obese do become obese. They, if you give them food, they will eat a whole lot of it. And whether it's high fat food or almost any kind of food, they become really rotund. They're quite chubby rats. So in this case, the researchers wanted to see whether exercise would sort of prevent that destiny. And so they gathered rats that were young. They were just on the cusp of rat teenage years.
Those rats, are rough years anyways, but go ahead.
They are. They're rough for rats also. But it's also the age when in people, a lot of young people start to pack on fat, not just weight, not muscle, but actual fat cells. And so the researchers were really interested in whether exercise at that stage of the mammal's life might change whether they got fat. And so they took these animals, and some of them they gave running wheels. I have allergies. I apologize.
No problem.
Even though these animals tend to get fat, they also still like to run. Most rodents do. So if you give them a running wheel, they will usually run. And some of the animals were kept, that they were allowed to eat as much as they want and were not given running wheels. And another group were basically put on a diet. They ate about 20% less than the other two animals. And they sort of followed these animals through what would be sort of middle age for us, mm-hmm. Which is another reason why I use animals, because that happens very quickly. And as it turned out, all of them had gained some weight. The animals that were allowed to eat as much as they want were just obese. They were very big. The other two animals, the ones that exercised and the ones that were on a diet, both remained fairly normal weight for rodents. But the animals that had exercised, not only did they move around a lot more all the time, but they had changes in their gut microbes that are associated with never getting fat.
Hmm.
So they seem to have literally reprogrammed their bodies. And so presumably, even as they went on into old age, they would not become fat animals. And that's pretty great.
That's kind of what we're shooting for.
Well, but it's a little bit depressing for those of us who are already, you know, in middle age. The clear lesson is you need to avoid putting on the fat in the first place. And it may well be that exercise is the key to that, which is another reason we need to get our kids active, because it may well be that if we're not keeping off the fat when people are young, we've made it so hard for them to take it off later in life.
You mentioned the brown and the white fat in your article. Is it one or the other is the kind that you can't get rid of, or that predicts that you'll have a harder time?
White fat is the stuff that we don't really want.
Okay.
Brown fat, which we do not have very much of once we're past the age of about 12 or so, it's definitely something you find a lot of in babies. One thing they did find is that exercise seemed to make the brown fat. Brown fat's actually metabolically active. It burns calories.
Okay.
Far more so than white fat. So you want brown fat. It also keeps you warm. But they did find that in the animals that exercised, their brown fat was more active. So they were burning more calories from their brown fat. They didn't add a lot more brown fat, but it was working harder.
And you need it.
You need it, absolutely. And if you can have brown fat, and there are some indications that exercise can either activate or even maybe increase the amount of brown fat that people have, not just animals, that does, at least to some extent, seem to change your metabolism. You will probably burn at least a few more calories every day.
It seems like I talk about the issue of gut microbes more and more often. They're really coming into a play in a lot of issues, right?
They are, and we don't. We really have just begun to understand the effect that your gut microbes have on your body and how your lifestyle affects your gut microbes. And there is some indication that whether you exercise or not and how much you exercise changes the composition of your gut microbes. And it appears to change them in ways that are fundamentally healthy. We don't understand some of what the changes mean. But it does seem that if you exercise, and this is in people, not just in rodents, that you do change the percentages of certain kinds of microbes in your gut. And it does seem to help with insulin resistance. It may help with keeping weight off. So that's one more reason to get out and move.
Until the day comes when we can test our microbes, but we can't yet, right? We can't it's not done yet.
Well, and even right now, even if we could, we don't know what it means. We don't know what, right. You know, one type of microbes, if you have more of them, what that really means for your health and fitness.
Recently on the show, we talked about the metabolic slowdown that commonly results from significant weight loss. Someone who loses 50 or 75 or even 100 pounds. Some contestants on that reality show, The Biggest Loser, experience this. And how does metabolism play a role? Is that what that brown fat is better at burning at?
Well, brown fat is much more, as I say, metabolically active. But it's also the amount of brown fat that any adult has, whether you're a rodent or a person, is very small compared to the amount of white fat you have. So even if you do get more and more metabolically active brown fat, it's a pretty small amount of additional energy. The problem is, and this is why I tried to stress how important it is to try not to gain that fat in the first place. Mm-hmm. Exercise does not seem to sort of normalize someone's metabolic rate if they've lost a huge amount of weight. They still have a really low metabolic rate, even if they exercise. So you're burning the calories through exercise, but you still, over the course of the day, use less calories than someone who has not lost that huge amount of weight.
Because that's your body trying to regain it.
Apparently, yes. And there does seem to be something about if you've already deposited that fat wants it back.
Mm-hmm.
If you can avoid the fat gain, because we also don't understand the whole physiology of fat cells. They really are very complicated, and there's a lot of work being done to try to understand how fat cells work, that they're not just sort of passive containers of fat.
Mm-hmm.
They actually send out messages to all parts of your body. They send out messages to muscle cells, to your brain, that seem to have effects that cause you to move less and eat more. So the more fat you deposit, the harder it's going to be throughout your life to lose it. Again, if it's possible not to gain it, you're going to be way ahead. And that doesn't mean be skinny.
Yeah.
It means once you've actually added fat, that is so hard to get rid of. So I wish I could tell you that exercise would ensure that you would lose the weight. It does not seem to be very effective for that. It can help people to keep weight off if they don't lose a huge amount of weight. But if you lose a lot of weight, your entire physiology seems to change, and it's really hard to keep it off.
So if you're somebody who's really thinking seriously about cutting back on exercise because of all of this, you just wrote about how 1 minute of strenuous exercise is comparable to working out for 45 minutes. Holy Toledo.
Yes.
Is this another rat experiment?
No, this was people.
Okay.
This was definitely, there's really good evidence that high intensity interval training, which means that you go really, really hard, you go just about as hard as you possibly can for a very short period of time, in this case, 20 seconds. You do that three times with a couple of minutes in between each of those intervals of going really slow. In this case, people rode an exercise bike as hard as they could for 20 seconds, then went really easy for 2 or 3 minutes, did it really hard again, easy for 2 or 3 minutes, and really hard again. So 1 minute of total exercise turned out to have virtually the exact same health and fitness benefits as 45 minutes of riding a bike at an easy pace.
So the benefit being stronger muscles, stronger bones, more calorie burning, what?
Well, it definitely raised their aerobic fitness, their endurance a lot, both of them, both of the types of exercise. And fitness, aerobic fitness is actually the best indicator of long-term health over the course of your life. It's actually the best indicator of how long you'll live. So all of these people increased their aerobic fitness to the same amount, even though one group was riding exercising five times as much as the other group. They also did lose body fat. So both groups changed their body composition. They weren't looking for weight loss, but they did lose some body fat. And so even though the group that was doing the intervals did 1 minute of hard exercise, they did lose some body fat. Whether, you know, that would stick a year from now, we don't know.
Right.
But it did help with body composition and with insulin response. So they definitely were getting both endurance and health benefits.
How was that conducted? How was that study conducted? I mean, you said they used like aerobic, you know, like on treadmills or on...
In this case, it was stationary bikes.
Stationary bikes, right.
It's really easy to...
Over the course of what period of time?
This was 12 weeks.
Okay.
Which for an exercise study is actually fairly long.
Yeah.
And they did compare, each of the groups was exercising three times a week. The group that did the intervals was exercising for a grand total of 10 minutes, which included a warm-up and a cool-down, the 1 minute of hard exercise, and several minutes of the really easy pedaling in between. The other group was doing 45 minutes of, you know, moderate pedaling, sort of what you would do if you went out for a bike ride. And as I said, each group did it three times a week. These were men that had been overweight and sedentary at the start, and they did it for 12 weeks. And at the end, they were almost exactly the same in terms of how much more fit and healthy they were.
A typical kind of workout class, let's just say a typical boot camp class, is like a high intensity interval workout.
Oh, nowadays, yes.
Yeah.
There's great enthusiasm about high intensity intervals because some people like them more, some people don't, but they're over with so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
People will usually do it. The biggest excuse still, if you ask people why they don't exercise, is they say they don't have time. So almost everyone really does have 10 minutes. You don't have to go to the gym. You can go out, run around your house.
Mm-hmm.
If you go as hard as you can for 20 seconds, that's an interval. It doesn't matter how you do it. It doesn't have to be on a stationary bicycle. It doesn't have to be on a treadmill. It's a matter of making yourself go, basically, think of it as at least a 9 on a scale of 1 to 10 of how hard this feels.
Oh, okay. All right. That's good to know.
But again, you're doing it for a very brief period of time. Warm up for a few minutes, you know, do whatever you're going to do gently, then go as hard as you can for 20 seconds. Do something easy, even if it's walking, for a couple of minutes and repeat 20 seconds of really hard work. Then, you know, do that one more time and you're done.
Gosh, I feel like I had such a great childhood. We used to get for dessert the opportunity to run around the house three times every night. So, and that we would. We thought that was dessert. So, Gretchen Reynolds, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Gretchen Reynolds, New York Times phys ed columnist. Thanks to everybody for listening today. You've heard from us on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.